From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore the history and landmarks along North Avenue to help understand how it became what it is today. Then, we'll speak with the lead organizer of Metcalf Park about how they're supporting neighborhood investment and revitalization along North Avenue.
The community has really took on repairing the harm of that divestment, and that's what we're up to today.
Plus, we'll examine the Milwaukee County budget.
This is the old budget environment that is new again. There are all these competing priorities, all these services that the county government provides in their own competition for this limited pool of funds.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with the series we've been bringing you on North Avenue. This week, we've explored its political importance and the demographic shifts along the 17-mile stretch from Milwaukee's east side out to Waukesha County. Today, WUWM's Mayan Silver speaks with historian John Gerda. He walks through the history and landmarks along the road to help us understand how North Avenue became what it is today.
Milwaukee is a city of neighborhoods. There's 191 neighborhoods, right?
That's a really variable count. Depends on who you're asking.
Okay.
There are scores of neighborhoods.
Scores. Upwards of 175.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Yeah. And North Avenue is an east-west street that cuts through or is the border or tip of about 20 of them, give or take, right?
Yep.
Okay. It also continues through Wauwatosa, Brookfield, and even a little bit of Pewaukee, if I'm not mistaken. What comes to mind as the overall importance of North Avenue to Metro Milwaukee throughout history? Like, just let's start there.
It's an interesting way to look at a city, kind of a transect through space and time. And North Avenue has been a border for a very long time in the early years, and it remains an arterial. So it's a section line. So when the area was surveyed back in the 1830s, it stood out. You know, it was kind of a line of demarcation. It was obviously going to be an arterial. So it spans, you know, just from the 1840s up to the, you know, the certainly in development modern terms, you know, look out there in Mayfair, 1960s and much later, you know, the McMansions out there in Brookfield. It's just a really, really kind of a rich slice of life in Milwaukee.
Yeah. What stands out to you when you think of North Avenue, like the grand expanse of it?
I start at the lake, and that goes back to certainly the first land sale is 1835. And interestingly, what you look at as East Side now, which is pretty desirable real estate, that was the northern border of Milwaukee. So the city incorporates back in 1846, and North Avenue is officially named in 1856. But North Avenue was the city limits. That was the edge of town. And beyond that was farmland, and it was back in the 1850s. St. Mary's Hospital, it was St. James early on, moved out there in 1858, you know, to that big complex there. Now it's Columbia St. Mary's there on North Avenue and Lake Drive. Hospitals back in those years were places where you went to die. So the hospital began downtown, and they did not want all these germs in the heart of the city. So the city fathers, they were fathers and not mothers, essentially moved St. Mary's out to the edge of town. They called it the seat of pestilence.
Whoa.
It had to be removed. So there was already at that site, there was already a poorhouse and there was a pest house, which was a very kind of a Dickensian, like a hellhole for people who were indigent and sick. So this began as social services way back in the 1840s. That's why you have all those social service institutions and schools right there in that section of the east side. So what became quite well healed began as anything but. So that's an interesting kind of a first chapter in the history of the east side and North Avenue. And right on the end of North Avenue, the big landmark there is the North Point Water Tower. And that goes back to 1871. And the water pumps were down there at the foot of the bluff, and they were pumping water to a reservoir in what's now Kilburn Park on North Avenue. You know, just on the west side of the Milwaukee River. And they put a standpipe in there 4 feet in diameter to relieve pressure on the mains, a very simple means of trying to ease up on the pipes is what it amounted to. And Milwaukee surrounded it with a sort of fairy tale castle, and that remains certainly the North Avenue icon on the lake. And it remains just a very, very powerful statement of kind of civic pride and possibility. Then you go farther west, you kind of get out of that social service corridor, and you've got the Five Points there around Farwell and North Avenue. And that's always been kind of entertainment and gathering. And one of the landmarks there is the Oriental Theater, 1927. So that was kind of the golden era of the movies, and that remains. You know, the Milwaukee Film Festival's there. That's, again, an iconic structure.
Yeah, Oriental opened on July 2nd, 1927, and my birthday is July 2nd, so I will always remember that. But the thing about North Avenue being the northernmost part of the city at one point, did that change just because of population growth?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Milwaukee kept on growing. Yes.
And then, you know, you were talking about the lake and the water tower and everything like that. North Avenue stops there, you know, overlooking the lake. Was there a reason that they didn't, you know, continue it all the way down to the shore?
That would have been a really rough ride down that hill.
Okay.
So they had the pumping station was down on the foot of the bluff, and then they had there were pipes underground pipes, and they would draw the water up. But it wasn't until 1929 when Lincoln Memorial Drive opened, then you had, you know, kind of switchback access to the lake. Before that, there was no lakefront. All that lakefront that we think of today is so gorgeous is landfill. You know, so there was no reason to go down there.
Wow. And the thing about even today, you know, North Avenue is one of the main ways that people from many different neighborhoods inside the city can get to the lake. Like, it's one of the main thoroughfares for that.
Yep.
But it wasn't at the time.
There was no lakefront to get to. Is
right.
what it amounts
yeah,
to.
Yeah, yeah. Gotcha. Fair enough. So then we've got that area on the east side, Murray Hill, and like different areas that head towards the river. Mm-hmm. And then there's the big curve overlooking, you know, there's a big view of the city with Kadish Park over there.
Right. And that's the reservoir that's right there. And that's connected to the water tower. Then you get into the Harambe neighborhood. You kind of skirt River West and you get into Harambe, which runs out to the freeway. And the big corner there, obviously, is what's now King Drive and North Avenue. And that was, going way back to the 1870s, that was the heartbeat of commercial German Milwaukee. So that was the downtown of Milwaukee's German population. And the big landmark there was Schuster's Department Store, which is on Garfield, just a block south. That opens back in 1884. And before long, you had so many businesses there that there were legends saying that there were people putting signs in windows saying English spoken here so they wouldn't scare away the occasional non-German who wandered by. That was really, really intensely German. So Milwaukee was a bilingual town back in those years, and the other lingua was German. And Rosenberg's clothing store was there. Bicker Gerner was there. But Schuster's, that was their flagship store. And they were the largest department store chain in Wisconsin and had no downtown location, which gives you some notion of how powerful, you know, those neighborhood shopping strips were. And now, you know, it's become the 21st century Bronzeville.
Yeah, you had a really interesting, nice way of describing it. You said that it's an old district brimming with new life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what happened was, as the Germans kind of moved northwest, there were a lot of Jewish, both residential and commercial, came into the area. So Bicker Gerner, among others, Rosenberg's as well. And you have the black population comes from the area just north of downtown, and they become the dominant group in that neighborhood, the old Sixth Ward. And it suffered through the riot of 1967, and the epicenter of that violence was the corner of 3rd and North, or King Drive and North Avenue, and pretty much became a commercial ghost town. And then in recent years, that's been rediscovered. Part of that is taking out the Park East Freeway, so you have this artificial barrier between downtown and the north side. That opens up, and you have all this investment kind of coming up King Drive. And now you've got the Black Holocaust Museum. You've got Urban League's been there for a long time. The Bronzeville Arts Collective, and this is happening right now. You know, this really is developing as we speak. And one of the big developments there, and I like kind of the historical kind of the moving back.
Circle of Life. Yeah.
Circle of Life, Thrive on King, which is the old Schuster department store, which is now the home of the Greater Milwaukee Foundation. Medical College, you know, has a big facility there and a lot of affordable housing. So you have this building that had stood vacant, you know, for decades, and now it's, again, brimming with new life. So there's a whole lot going on there. It's fun to see.
This is Lake Effect. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with historian John Gerda. You know, looking at the stretch of North Avenue, I guess, from about that Bronzeville, because Bronzeville ends at about 12th, mm-hmm. and then at about 12th through the rest of the city, what's notable to know about that area, like to maybe like 55th?
When you move kind of farther west, you know, you're kind of moving from the Harambe neighborhood to Lindsay Heights and then Amani, more recent names. And part of what you see there when you're up around 17th, 20th, where Fond du Lac comes through there, Jake's Deli is there, has been there for a very long time. And that's kind of a landmark of the Jewish settlement in that area. What's now Greater Galilee Baptist Church began as Beth Israel on Titonia there. So you have strong evidence of the Jewish population in that neighborhood. Joe Zilber, the Zilber Realty, was from that neighborhood. Max Cole, you know, had early stores there on King Drive and West. And one of the big things happening there now is Walnut Way, which is around 17th, 18th, 19th and North Avenue. Wellness, urban gardening, housing, reclamation. Sharon and Larry Adams have been kind of the dominant figures there. So a whole lot of energy in that area as well. Then you get farther west, and you've got the old Sears store on Fond du Lac and North. And then you've got the old Park West Freeway Corridor that was thousands of people were displaced for that corridor for a freeway that was never built. And there's still open land there, you know, after what's been, at this point, you're talking 50, 60 years, you know, so that was a real body blow to that entire neighborhood.
What streets is that area?
Roughly from Fond du Lac out to Sherman Boulevard, you know, so that area was, they took the area just north of North Avenue, so that corridor was a block-wide swath of housing and businesses that was just erased, just completely erased. Loss of tax base, loss of population, and loss of a sense of place in that neighborhood as well. And I think that slowly is being recovered. A lot of community efforts there to kind of rebuild a sense of place, a sense of belonging. Then you get out to Sherman Park. So Washington Park's on your left or the south, Sherman Park's on the right. And now you're in housing that was developed in the 1920s when you had zoning, when you had building code setbacks, and when you had cars. So it looks, now you're getting into the modern era, you know, kind of. It was in some ways sort of a suburb in the city. A lot of Germans, a lot of Jewish residents as well. And the line there is the 30th Street Industrial Corridor that was second only to the Menominee Valley in terms of industrial jobs. And that has been pretty much hammered economically and is now slowly but steadily coming back. Talk about a bike path, you know, down there in that corridor. So there's energy there as well. But that became the border between kind of the old, kind of the 19th century city and the more modern, you know, 20s and later city. Then you move out, keep on going farther west, and you've got Washington Heights kind of going out to that neighborhood, and you go all the way out to Highway 100 and 108th Street and Mayfair. So, and what's interesting, Mayfair goes back to, I think, the 60s, and that became a center of commerce and in some ways echoes the center of commerce at King and North, 3rd and North. You know, so you have the continuity across generations and how we do things differently. You know, the automobile oriented shopping center with an ocean of parking, you know, compared to the streetcar, the commercial strips, King Drive and North, certainly see an interesting contrast.
Amazing. Like, you know, one is very walkable and very neighborhood based and very like more mom and pop shops. It was, there was like a history of jazz and entertainment.
Yeah, right. And a lot of entertainment.
And a lot of that area. And then Mayfair had for decades until the sort of like delivery Amazon era was like a major shop corridor, is what you're saying.
Right.
So when you're looking, you know, if you drive from the east side looking at the lake, starting near the lake, and then just drive down North Avenue and traverse like all the different neighborhoods, you can really see a through street of Milwaukee's economic, racial, and political diversity, but also its segregation.
Mm-hmm.
Is there like one historical development that has created that?
No. It's a complex of many different things. A lot of it, you know, is the, you know, Milwaukee, like most northern industrial cities, you know, had an area that was, the inner core is kind of a, it's sort of a trope in the American landscape, family of landscapes. And what happened, I think there was prosperity for a time in the 1960s and 70s, largely based on manufacturing jobs. And then the bottom falls out in the 1980s. And what happened was as people lost those manufacturing jobs, and there had been roughly twice the proportion of black workers in production jobs as white workers. These are union jobs in a union town, you know, so they were doing very well. Then we lose a quarter of our manufacturing jobs in 4 years from 1979 to 1983, and last hired, first fired. You know, so you have, you know, certainly a catastrophic impact on Milwaukee's black community. And what happened basically was if you can't move up, you can't move out. So you have kind of that landscape is frozen in place. So certainly, you know, racism was involved as was causative in the first years of segregation, but that became frozen in many ways by the economic travails of the late 20th century. And nothing has yet, you know, replaced those jobs, and kind of that's an American issue. It's not just Milwaukee, but yeah, you can see it. You know, you cross that swath from roughly you know, King Drive, you know, out to about 35th or so. You know, that certainly is, you see some rather challenging living conditions there. Absolutely.
Is there anything that gives you hope? You've talked about a few of those things.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun to see things like Bronzeville. I mean, that the King and North. If you grew up here. Back in the 60s and 70s, you know, that was pretty forlorn. And now it's kind of brimming with new life. And you look at some of the things a little bit farther south from there, what's now the Deer District, you know, that was as impoverished a section as Milwaukee's ever had. Eastern European Jews and then black residents, it's now the Deer District. You know, I mean, the shiny kind of new neighborhood in Milwaukee. So yeah, cities are always reinventing themselves, and there's always reason for hope.
Well, John Gerda, thank you so much for taking us on this little trip through history along this major Milwaukee through street on North Avenue.
My pleasure, Mayan.
That was Milwaukee historian John Gerda talking with WUWM's Mayan Silver about North Avenue. In about 15 minutes, we'll look at funding Milwaukee County. But first, we'll wrap up our series on North Avenue with a conversation with someone who works along that corridor about what's being done to improve it. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In our last segment, we learned about the history of North Avenue. Now, we're turning to one of the organizations making positive changes along the corridor. Metcalf Park is a neighborhood that borders North Avenue from 27th Street to 38th. WUWM's Mayan Silver speaks with Melody McCurtis, Deputy Director and Lead Organizer of Metcalf Park Community Bridges. It's a resident-led nonprofit that supports neighborhood investment and revitalization and has its office on North Avenue.
We've been talking to people with some insights about North Avenue, and of course it stretches from Lake Michigan to the east all the way out to Waukesha County in the west, and you at Metcalf Park are one of the stops in between. What can you tell me about Metcalf Park and particularly its stretch along North Avenue?
Yeah, so North Avenue is in the process of being developed in Metcalf Park. On our 30th Street corridor, we've been able to work with We Energies and MATC to really develop a big plot of land there into a training facility, as well as adding some green infrastructure to help with the flooding on that side of Metcalf Park, and also support community members with a a walk to train training program with full ride scholarships through MATC so that community members can become fully certified line mechanics. In addition to that, a part of that land is going to be a communal space where folks can just come and sit and reflect and just be in the community. As you go farther up on North Avenue in Metcalf Park, we have schools, we have childcare facilities. We have, you know, our office building is on North Avenue. We have some stores, some small businesses along North Avenue as well. But it's up and coming. It's up and coming.
And one of the reasons it's up and coming is all the work that you're doing and all the work that the community is doing. But I want to talk historically, because the area along North Avenue where Metcalf Park is was basically razed in the 1960s to build a highway, the Avenues West Highway. There was going to be a circle of highways in Milwaukee, and the Sherman Park neighborhood eventually stopped that from happening. But North Avenue and a lot of that stretch was left with empty lots. And in some places, the effects are still felt today. Can you tell me about the ways that that has impacted the neighborhood?
Yeah, so that impact is, you know, quite frankly, it's historical disinvestment, right? We had a lot of booming jobs in the community along North Avenue, especially on the 30th Street corridor. A lot of those facilities are just still there and they're vacant. So what you see in the 60s, although it happened in the 60s, has been affecting the day-to-day in 2024, right? So the community has really took on repairing the harm of that divestment. And that's what we're up to today.
That kind of segues into the fact that Metcalf Park Community Bridges is a grassroots movement. It's aimed at re-empowering and reclaiming the community. And one of the things I love about Metcalf Park Community Bridges is how welcoming you are and how creative you are. You have events centering joy with painting and DJs. You provide food to the community. Tell me about your approach to community reinvestment.
Yeah, our approach to community reinvestment is that the community should be deciding what they want for their community, right? So it should be development that's rooted in social justice. It should be development that's community led. So nothing should be implemented without the community's full support and not buy-in. So when people say buy-in, we don't want folks introducing a plan to our folks. We want folks to actually involve them in the beginning, the middle, and the end of the process. One of those examples along North Avenue, there is a Metcalf Park playfield. And what you'll see is that the community is doing a lot of envisioning and imagining and putting together these pieces to really influence investment in the city. So with the Metcalf Park playfield, that's been a vacant lot, two vacant lots. The other vacant lot has been gated, right? So the community hasn't had access to it. Through that two-year imagination process, the community has been able to design a space that's going to be implemented next year that has been fully designed for them, by them.
And one of the ways you're doing that, the for them, by them, is doing things like going door to door all year round and also during election seasons. You have community surveys. You're asking the community how it wants to rebuild and reinvest and create a sense of place. What are the main things you're hearing?
So some of the main things that we're hearing is that our community has been outraged at some of the things that's happening in the community where they weren't a part of. So most recently with the growing MKE plan, that plan is a plan around zoning that will change the makeup of neighborhoods in terms of housing, businesses, and et cetera. Because the community voiced that they were unaware of this plan, we were able to push back and halt that plan from being implemented. And now DCD is working with us in the community to develop a re-engagement process to make sure that our community is at the table. So the first thing that we always deal with anything in terms of our community, we have to start with a fight to make sure that our community is not invisible. And then we have to work with folks to understand that everybody will be better off if you include the people that development should benefit.
You're tuned into Lake Effect. I'm Mayan Silver, speaking with Melody McCurtis of Metcalf Park Community Bridges. Okay, so you were just talking about how important it is when there's development in Milwaukee to repair the community and to involve folks that are in the community. You were talking about some forms of disinvestment. We talked about the Avenues West Highway Project, which destroyed buildings. What else are you seeing historically were impacting the community?
Yeah, so the highways is one way that you cripple a community. Another way that you cripple a community is when resources leave the neighborhood, right? So in the 90s, you had the Urban Milwaukee right in Metcalf Park. You had, Miss Avis had a grocery store for about 40 years, is one of the only Black-owned grocery stores. When you see clinics leaving the neighborhood, so Next Door Pediatrics, Children's Pediatrics just left the community in December, and they made a notice in November, right? So those are some of the new ways that you're seeing disinvestment in the community, right? We should be able to have as many clinics in our neighborhoods that we have liquor stores and corner stores. We should have multiple grocery stores, not just relying on one grocery store that is for multiple neighborhoods. We should be able to walk and support a small business on our corridors. So those are some of the things that we're seeing right now. And because of all this historical disinvestment, it costs more to reimagine these spaces and these places that have been abandoned. And then when we think about, you know, businesses just didn't leave, right? Highways wasn't just built. Those highways weren't completed. Those businesses left, but those buildings stayed, right? And those toxins have stayed in our community as well, right? So we have to think about who left, why they left, right? And what did they leave us with? They should have been the ones to clean it up, right? But here we are in 2024, cleaning up the mess and repairing our community from the inside out. So we really need some real investment. We need folks who are in position of power to direct investment to the community in the way the community is asked.
And you were at the outset of this interview talking about several things that the community is doing and investing into the community, whether it's green infrastructure or training for mechanic-specific jobs, opening communal spaces. At this point, what are you most optimistic about? What is working the best?
I'm really optimistic, and what I've been really excited about and proud of is that our community just keeps showing up. They've been showing up to these budget hearings. They've been showing up to these, you know, state budget hearings and county budget hearings. They've been showing up in these different spaces that they aren't usually invited to, right? Or, you know, they're not invited in a way where they'll come, right? Nobody's knocking on their door or inviting them to these different places. They're not making it accessible. They keep showing up. They're asking the questions, and then they're also formulating their own recommendations, right? So that's what I'm most proud of, is that Metcalf Park keeps showing up. They keep building out what they want. They're building alternatives to policing. They're building alternatives to the devaluation of our neighborhoods. They're doing the work together. You know, they're still running a mutual aid network that was created in the pandemic, and it's still going strong. So they are really creating a community that keeps each other safe for real, right? And they're also imagining and visioning together. So that's what I'm most proud of. I'm extremely proud of my community.
And back to the North Avenue connection, you mentioned your office is on North Avenue. What role does North Avenue play in the Metcalf Park neighborhood? And are there any plans for coming up for that stretch of North Avenue?
You know, Metcalf Park is in the center of Milwaukee. You can get everywhere. You can get anywhere and everywhere in Milwaukee within 8 to 15 minutes from North Avenue, right? So it is a hub, right, that thousands of folks use every day. So our vision is that it becomes walkable, right? It becomes safe in a way where we have some green infrastructure, right? Because we are in a heat island. We have some serious and well thought out protective bike lanes, and we have some art all down North Avenue. And that we have some businesses that reflect what the community says they need.
Nice. Do you have any current favorite stops on North Avenue?
Yeah, so my favorite stop right now would be our office, because we do a lot of different events out of our office. 38th, when you get off on 38th, you can, you know, turn right and go right to Butterfly Park. On 34th and North, you turn right, you'll have the Metcalf Park playfield. It's going to have some beautiful installations of water, green infrastructure, basketball courts. All of these different things will be right there. Another stop that I like is the 30th Street Corridor, that training ground right there on 30th and North. So North Avenue in the next coming years will be the place to be in Metcalf Park for the entire family, right?
Melanie McCurtis of Metcalf Park Community Bridges, thank you so much for speaking with me about Metcalf Park, North Avenue, and everything that your community is doing.
Thank you so much.
That was Melody McCurtis, Deputy Director of Metcalf Park Community Bridges, speaking with WUWM's Mayon Silver. You can hear all of Mayon's reporting about North Avenue's political and historical importance at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn why Friday the 13th is associated with bad luck and holds an ominous place in our culture. But first, we'll learn about Milwaukee County's paratransit program, which lost funding a year ago. We'll learn what advocates have done since then to still try to provide transportation services to people living with disabilities. Stay tuned to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. County Executive David Crowley released his proposed 2025 budget this week. He says the $1.4 billion plan focuses on, quote, financial sustainability. But the county is, once again, facing financial challenges in the years ahead, and cuts are needed to be made. One of the programs on the chopping block is the county's same-day on-demand paratransit system. Milwaukee is the only county in Wisconsin that offers this service for people with disabilities, and is one of only a handful of counties nationwide offering something like it. A year ago, Lake Effect Sam Woods spoke with transit officials and advocates about the sudden loss of this service. He returned to speak with paratransit advocates and officials about how the service returned in September, with new rules and a new name, but is still facing an uncertain future.
Every budget season, numbers take center stage. Government officials speak of moving money around to balance revenue and costs, avoiding cuts where possible, and highlighting new investments. It's a time where dreams meet sobering realities. Earlier this week, County Executive David Crowley did just this when he spoke in front of the County Board of Supervisors about his proposed 2025 budget.
And while I am proud of what we have accomplished, we are simply not out of the woods yet. We know structural deficits have returned and will be back again in the near future. We know that the new sales tax revenue needs to pick up. And we know that the cost of state mandated services are accelerating faster than we can actually pay for them.
But when it comes to budgets, people like Kevin Myers are interested in the details. Myers is retired, but he stays busy serving on numerous nonprofit and government committees, while training all summer for a recent tandem bike ride across Wisconsin.
I like to keep active. I've never been one that likes to just sit at home and do nothing or watch TV. I just, that's just not me. I like to get out there and do things. And that's what tandem bike racing does. It provides me that ability to get out there and stay active.
Myers is also blind, which can make it challenging to move around the city to various appointments. Until last year, Myers utilized Milwaukee County's on-demand paratransit service to get around, especially for last-minute work meetings and unexpected medical appointments. The service was subsidized by the county government and functioned like a low-cost rideshare service for people with disabilities, similar to a Lyft or Uber, but cheaper. It's a service that's pretty rare for governments to offer, with Milwaukee being the only county in Wisconsin and one of only a handful nationwide to offer something like this for people with disabilities. But a year ago, this service suddenly ended after it was discovered that the program was in violation of federal law requiring paratransit services to be wheelchair accessible and for drivers to undergo regular drug testing. In short, the program was cut due to cost, because to meet these regulations necessitated an investment in the program that the county deemed too costly. And this left people like Myers uncertain about the future.
Personally, I had some anger, I guess you could say, and some fear about what was going to happen, because I used the taxi service quite often to go to a doctor's appointment, many different things I'd use the cab for. It's usually 3-4 times a week that I would use it.
To be clear, Milwaukee County was still providing paratransit rides for people with disabilities at this time, as required in the Americans with Disabilities Act. But these rides needed to be scheduled at least 24 hours in advance, which did not make them a feasible option for emergency appointments. And perhaps more importantly, these vans are not seen as reliable by many of their riders, with many reporting missed pickups, long rides, and consistently late arrivals to appointments. But the process by which the program ended, suddenly and without warning, also left a bad taste in Myers' mouth, after he had come to rely on the service since its inception in 2000.
I felt it was very dissatisfying that Transit Plus went and made the decision without asking users, riders, how they felt about this going away. They just decided they were going to stop it. And, of course, I can understand because of federal regulations. And I would think they would at least ask the riders, okay, you know, is there something else we could do? Or maybe the Transit Plus should have looked into, let's see if we can do something else, rather than just stop it.
Donna Brown Martin, director of the Milwaukee County Department of Transportation, shared Myers' concern about this program ending, and she noticed advocates stepping up to help formulate a solution during last year's budget cycle.
It kind of generated out of the effort by the county board last year for the 2024 budget. Folks presented this issue as a critical issue for them. And so there were stakeholders from the blind community as well as the disabled community that really raised their hands and stepped up and said, we need to talk with county officials in the administration about how we move forward.
And thus, the Paratransit Taxi Task Force was born, made up of county officials like Brown Martin and advocates like Myers. Taking almost a year, the two sides worked out a plan to bring back an on-demand transit option for people with disabilities in Milwaukee County. Both Myers and Brown Martin noted that the process started out rocky. The two sides had trouble meeting in the middle, balancing advocates' wishes with the county's fiscal realities.
We started out rocky, really needed to, from a county perspective and MCTS perspective, we really needed to sit down and listen to what people's concerns were, what their fears were. It's scary to be out there without a service that had been available to them, but no longer was an opportunity for them to use in the future. We needed to identify what we could do for them in terms of providing a service that met their needs, but still fell within the requirements of Federal Transit Administration in terms of the delivery of that service. And so there was a lot of talking initially, a lot of listening.
But eventually, the two sides compromised enough to bring a same-day, on-demand paratransit option back. The result was a new pilot program that launched in early September, which allows up to 8 wheelchair-accessible rides per month that costs a rider $10 per one-way trip. The pilot program was given $1 million to test the demand and viability of the program for as long as possible. Graham Kilmer, reporter at Urban Milwaukee, noted that while this process was, at times, messy, all actors, county officials, and community advocates did exactly what they're supposed to do. They played by the rules, they set goals, and they heard each other's concerns to find a solution.
The task force deserves some kudos. And all these people who are private citizens who dedicated hours of their life, both in meetings and outside, to come up with the solution for people who have disabilities, people who have loved ones and children with disabilities, who made very clear on many occasions that without a same-day transportation option, that they would miss doctor's appointments, they would miss job interviews, they would be late to work, all these things. So I definitely think that the task force deserves a round of applause and should be viewed as a model of something that government did well.
However, the program is still in limbo. While riders are charged $10 per ride, the cost for the county is $98 per hour, which covers things like random drug testing of drivers, insurance, gas, and driver wages and benefits. A year ago, this fiscal burden may not have been as much of a sticking point, as the county's financial situation was historically good. Kilmer explains how just 1 year later, that has changed.
So last year they had the first surplus in a very long time, and that meant they were able to invest in a lot of things, and they put a ton of money into parks. They put $17 million into the transit system. They really were able to make historic investments, like a lot of them said in their press releases. They really did make historic investments. The thing is that the sales tax was never going, this was never going to be a permanent state of affairs. Even before it was passed, the comptroller released a report showing that county budget deficits are going to return in 2026. They are returning a year early. And part of that is because a number of things were funded in the budget that did kind of push that annual operating cost up a little bit higher, just into that territory where, okay, next year is going to be a little tighter. And then also, of all things, sales tax revenue is down. The county is taking in significantly less sales tax revenue than they expected.
As of now, the same-day on-demand paratransit pilot program is still operating off its initial $1 million of funding. If nothing changes, the pilot will end once that money is spent, most likely before next year's budget cycle, and advocates like Kevin Myers will be back to relying on friends and family for rides to unexpected medical and employment appointments. But this program is not the only county initiative fighting for a piece of the proposed $1.4 billion budget, and the County Board of Supervisors will have decisions to make this month about which programs will be cut. Over the next month, the merits of fully funding on-demand paratransit will be weighed against funding requested by the Sheriff's Office, other department operations within MCTS, or even initiatives relating to things like early childhood education, repairs to the county courthouse, or pretrial services for people entering the criminal justice system. Kilmer explains.
So, to bring it back to paratransit, this is the old budget environment that is new again, in that there are all these competing priorities, all these services that the county government provides, and they're all in competition for this limited pool of funds. By the way, this pool of funds isn't even enough to fund what's currently going on right now. So unfortunately for this new pilot program, yes, it's going into the budget season and it's going to be a tough one.
That piece was produced by Lake Effect Sam Litz. More information about the Milwaukee County budget can be found at WUWM.com. It's October, which means spooky season is here. One of the most iconic series that people will be tuning into this Halloween season is Friday the 13th. The slasher franchise takes its name from a day of bad luck. For some, a day of terror or taboo. While there isn't a Friday the 13th this month, there was one back in September and one later in the year in December. But what makes Friday the 13th such a foreboding date? Anna Lardnoy is an expert in all things ghostly or sinister, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the legend of Friday the 13th.
So what is the history behind specifically the number 13? Because it seems like that's where a lot of this starts.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a word for the fear of the number 13. It's triskaidekaphobia. And studies say 10% of Americans are fearful of the number 13. And 8% are fearful of Friday the 13th, which we are having this week. So this goes back to, many people say, before biblical times. We see the Code of Harambe. It is an ancient list of laws from 1754 BC. And in that list of 282 laws of the land, they've omitted the number 13. So this fear of that number goes back all that way. And some people think it could be even biblically related. If we look at the Last Supper, we see that there were 13 guests, and that 13th guest, Judas, was the person who led to that being the Last Supper. And that's not the only story that has 13 guests. We have a piece of Norse mythology where Odin is having a dinner party, and it is disrupted by his 13th guest, Loki. So that appears in a lot of different cultures. 13 seems to be woven through many of our Western traditions as just being unlucky.
It seems like, as I was looking into this, part of it appears to be that 12 is a very complete number. There are a number of things that have 12, like the 12 tribes of Israel, for mm-hmm. example. But a lot of cultures use 12 as this kind of complete whole number. And then 13 ends up being kind of a bad omen of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
When we come to Friday especially, is that a biblical link? Is that why Friday is
well,
no good?
We do have some biblical connections for Friday being no good. We have the Good Friday is celebrating the death of, well, actually the resurrection, but you—
Crucifixion.
Crucifixion, right. And then we have Adam and Eve being ejected from the Garden of Eden on Friday. As a person who writes a lot about shipwrecks, I noticed that mariners also have a deep fear of Fridays and, in fact, often will avoid scheduling journeys that begin on Fridays. It's supposed to be a bad omen for the entire journey. So they may even leave at, let's say, 11:57 p.m. rather than waiting until after midnight on a Friday to begin their journey because they do not want to mess with the superstitions.
Are there any concrete examples of Friday the 13th actually being unlucky?
Well, we might remember where we all were on March 13th, 2020, because that is the day that lockdown began. And so that was a Friday the 13th. And we could argue that that was, you know, a very unlucky day for all of us. There are, I think, more cultural reminders that 13th is unlucky. We've got the 1980s slasher series of films, Friday the 13th. We have hotels and other large buildings feeding into this by avoiding having a 13th floor. So I think it's so embedded in culture, it would be difficult to say which came first, the unluckiness of the number or that we give reverence to the bad luck.
Well, that gets to my final question, really. How do we see this living on today? Do we see the fear of the 13 in not having a 13th floor, in avoiding 13s of any kind?
I think it's so embedded in our culture, we probably won't get away from it. I kind of like to think about how maybe the spookiest of all Americans that are living today, Stephen King, claims to have this fear of the number 13. And if noted horror master, who can create some of the worst things that we can imagine, is afraid of this number, perhaps there's credence.
All right. Well, my mom will be happy to hear about that. She is not a fan of 13. Anna, as always, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Lardnoy is the founder of Gothic Milwaukee and the author of several books about ghost stories in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about Friday the 13th in 2022. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayon Silver from the WUWM News team and Morning Edition host Rachel Owens this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarra-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn about Wisconsin's 77th Allison Dairyland and how she helps promote the state's agriculture industry. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.